Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm going to cover in this audio Proverbs chapter 5. I will entitle the chapter Warning Against Adultery. Of course, Solomon wrote this psalm, and we begin now by reading verses 1 through 10. Solomon begins, "My son, give attention to my wisdom, incline your ear to my understanding, that you may observe discretion and your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways are unstable. She does not know it. Now then, my sons, listen to me, and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her, and do not go near the door of her house. Or you will give your vigor to others, and your years to the cruel one. And strangers will be filled with your strength, and your hard-earned goods will go to the house of an alien." Well, Solomon more or less gives us his view of what his opinion is about adulterers or adulteresses. He knows the attraction of the opposite sex, and he's trying to instruct his naive son about the dangers that that attraction could lead to. Now, who is his son? In verse 1, he says, "My son." Well, it could be Rehoboam, who certainly didn't show too much wisdom in his life. Rehoboam was Solomon's son, who inherited the kingdom of Israel from Solomon when Solomon died, and then proceeded to split the kingdom up in a civil war by refusing to give tax relief to the northern 10 tribes. But it could be another son of Solomon. Some have even suggested that the son is the son of wisdom personified, that wisdom which is mentioned all the way through these first chapters of Proverbs, capital W, wisdom, as a she. So Solomon says in verse 1, "Son, incline your ear to my understanding. Bend your ear down next to my lips so you can hear real good, or you can hear real well. You can hear real well what I'm about to tell you." Verse 2, "that you may observe discretion." Discretion is another word for wisdom. The son observes discretion by listening to Solomon's understanding. In verse 1, "my understanding," Solomon's understanding. That, of course, is just another synonym for wisdom. In verse 2, Solomon wants his son to reserve knowledge. That's the NASB translation, which is not very clear. What does it mean to reserve knowledge? The NIV has preserve knowledge. The Holman Christian Study Bible has safeguard knowledge. In other words, Solomon wants his son to keep wisdom alive by speaking wisdom. His lips may preserve knowledge by speaking wisdom after Solomon shuffles off his mortal coil. Verse 3, Solomon continues, "For the lips of an adulteress drip honey." Here's some other scriptures, or at least one other scripture, one other proverb, Proverbs 7:5, that states the same thing. "She," referring to wisdom, "she will keep you from a forbidden woman, a stranger with her flattering talk." Forbidden woman, of course, is an adulteress. Here's some other scriptures talking about how deadly adulteresses might be, all of them from Solomon, Ecclesiastes 7:26. "And I discovered more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her." Sounds like Solomon is talking about a personal experience. "I discovered more bitter than death." I still can't figure out how a man who has 1,000 wives and concubines would ever need to commit adultery, or would even be able to commit adultery. How do you find a woman that you're not legally married to commit adultery with? But at any rate, Solomon also said at Proverbs 23:27, "For a harlot is a deep pit, and an adulterous woman is a narrow well." Now, of course, a harlot might not be an adulteress. She's just a prostitute for hire. She's put in parallel with an adulterous woman who is not paid for her services, but nonetheless, she is committing a very grave sin. I would say adultery is worse than harlotry because there's another party involved with adultery. The cuckolded husband is probably going to be pretty upset about his wife committing adultery. Solomon says in Proverbs 22:14, "The mouth of an adulteress is a deep pit. He who is cursed of the Lord will fall into it." Cursed of the Lord now. That's what God thinks about adultery. He curses adulterers. That ought to keep young men, and women too, to keep their pants zipped up. Solomon says in verse 3, Proverbs 5, that the adulteress's lips drip honey. Eating honey gives sensual pleasure, just like kissing an adulteress would give sensual pleasure. But the whole problem here is that the sensual desire overrides common wisdom. All sin tastes good at first, otherwise people wouldn't do it. I'm sure that first drag on a marijuana cigarette or that first snort of cocaine feels real good. That's why people do it. But the problem is that death ensues. Same with adultery. Smoother than oil is her speech, Solomon says in verse 3. Olive oil makes bread go down the throat very pleasantly. I've gotten to where I love olive oil. And you put olive oil on bread, oh my goodness, that's good. And I'm sure that adulteress tasted good too, until she kills you. Verse 4, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood. As I said, sin starts out sweet, ends up bitter. Like that old song, that old Carole King song, tonight I give my love so sweetly, but will you still love me tomorrow? No, he won't. Yeah, adultery sweet, fornication sweet, but what does it lead to? A lot of bad, bad stuff. But in the end, the adulteress is bitter as wormwood. Now, wormwood is defined by dictionary.com as a bitter aromatic plant, absinthium of the old world, used as a vermifuge and a tonic, and as an ingredient in absinthe. Well, I don't know what absinthe is, and I didn't know what a vermifuge was, but I looked it up. A vermifuge is a medicine that expels intestinal worms. And so, you want to have the worms in your intestines expelled from your body? Go into an adulteress. She'll knock those intestinal worms right out. And I suspect that it won't be pleasant. And you'll know that when you drink that stuff, that wormwood, it goes down very, very bitter. The NIV has gall for wormwood. John Gill says that this is a metaphor for loss of credit, substance and health, remorse of conscience and fear of death, corporeal and eternal. So you go into an adultery, you lose your reputation, your loss of credit, you lose your substance, you lose your money because you have to pay for the bastard children that might ensue, you lose your health because you'll get an STD, your conscience will bother you because you cheated on your wife, and then fear of death, corporeal, if that STD advances to the stage where you're about to croak, and also eternal death because God puts curses on adulterers, as we just read. Verse 5, Solomon continues, her feet go down to death, her steps take hold of Sheol. Sheol, of course, is the Hebrew word. That means grave or pit, sometimes the shadowy underworld where the departed spirits go, just like the Greek Hades. Here it's talking about death, her steps take hold of Sheol. She will lead you to death. The NIV translates, she will go down to death. You want to die? Commit adultery. Verse 6, the adulteress does not ponder the path of life. Her ways are unstable. She does not know it. What does it mean that she does not know that what she is doing leads to death? Well, most sinners think they're going to get away with it. Most adulteresses think that, oh, this is fun. This will relieve me from my boring marriage. I'll just go down to my computer, get on Ashley Madison, find somebody I can commit adultery with. I won't leave my husband or my kids. I'll just spice up things a little bit. That's the way these morons that get on Ashley Madison, that's exactly the way they think. A lot of them do, according to my preliminary research. And so they don't realize they're playing with fire. They don't know what's going to happen to them. They think they're going to get away with it. They might get away with it in the short term in this life, but by golly, they're not going to get away with it in the next life, when they have to face the great assize presided over by the God who made the universe and who set up certain laws that he wants his human creation to operate by. Verse 7, Solomon continues, now then, my sons, listen to me. He's gone from my son to my sons, plural. Listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her, far from the adulteress. Do not go near the door of her house. If you don't go near the door of a house, you're not going to cross the threshold and go in. This is just a way of saying, don't even get close to the temptation. Now, that's an interesting idea about getting close to temptation. It's a little rabbit trail here. Obviously, as far as possible, one should not test one's ability to resist temptation. For example, a recovering alcoholic should not go into a bar and say, I don't need to drink this stuff, I'm cured. Well, that's just plain stupid. But what happens if he has an alcoholic son that's in a bar and he needs to go get him? Is he going to say, well, no, I'm not going to go into a bar, I need to resist temptation? No, he'll go into the bar to retrieve his son. So we don't want to make an absolute rule out of avoiding temptation. This is a general rule, like all the rules in Proverbs. Here's a contrary instance of the general rule that you should stay away from temptation, not be alone with women that aren't your wife. Jesus was alone with a Samaritan woman. And as we know, Jesus could be tempted. He was tempted in the wilderness by hunger, but that didn't bother him. He carried out his ministry as he needed to. But in general, there would be no need to go near the door of an adulteress unless one was up to no good. And there might be a situation where you might need to go near the door of an adulteress. Life is complicated. It's full of all kind of interesting permutations and combinations of experiences. But in general, stay away from that lady. Stay away from that whore. In verse 9, Solomon says, if you go near the door of her house, you will give your vigor to others. What does that mean, give your vigor to others? John Gill puts it this way, quote, either wealth or riches. The vigor is either wealth or riches, which make men honorable, or credit and reputation, which are lost by keeping company with such persons, or the outward comeliness of the body and inward rigor of the mind, which are impaired by adulterous practices, in other words, STDs. You go nuts, and your body will start falling apart, getting blistered with boils. The harlot herself may be here meant, who, when she has got what she can, has no pity on the man she has ruined, and even will not stick to take away his life upon occasion. In other words, you give your vigor, it means you give your vigor to the harlot, and she'll kill you. She has no pity on you. She is, as Gill says, as he continues, she is the cause and means of the damnation of the man's soul. Or the jealous husband of the adulterous woman who will not spare the adulterer when taken by him. That's how you can give your vigor to others. You can give your vigor to the harlot, she'll break your heart. You can give your vigor to the prostitute's husband, and he'll kill you. That happens all the time. Enraged, jealous husbands come after you with a gun. Happened right down the street from me in a churchyard. Man came out and started shooting, trying to plug the adulterer, the man who was committing adultery with his wife. Or the adulterer, or the man who goes into the adulteress, he could give his vigor to the whore's, the adulteress's brethren, her relations and friends, or her other gallants and co-rivals, her former boyfriends, who, when they have the opportunity, will avenge themselves. For example, the husband's relatives might think, hey, this man is seducing the wife of my relative. I'm going to take care of him. Or the man may be giving his vigor to the civil magistrate who executes judgment without mercy on such delinquents, this being a sin punished with death in the Old Testament. Of course, today adultery is just laughed at. It's on the books in some places. Doesn't mean a thing. Might affect a divorce settlement. But as far as criminal law, nah. We're above such things now. We're free. We're a free country. We're free to let men marry men and women marry women, and we're free to commit adultery. That's okay. Or at least it's getting that way. Now in verse 9, Solomon says, you will give your vigor to others if you go into the adulteress, and you will give your years to the cruel one. That translation is NASB, a little bit too specific, the cruel one. Holman Christian Study Bible says, you will give your vigor to someone cruel, and Gill has already told you about who some of those cruel people might be, relatives of the adulteress, ex-boyfriends, the civil magistrate who's going to prosecute you, the adulteress herself who breaks your heart. Maybe you'll give your vigor away by getting an STD or going nuts. Verse 10, Solomon says, and strangers will be filled with your strength if you go into the adulteress. Well, what strangers will be filled with the man's strength, the son's strength? Well, John Gill suggests the adulteress, her husband, children, friends, bawds, and such like persons she is concerned with. A bawd, I think, is an old-fashioned English word for the madam of a house of ill repute. Adultery is bad business, folks. Think of the money that is spent on bastard children that should go to the wife and her kids. So your money's going to be going to strangers, people you don't know. Now, of course, strangers in this translation, this context here, is talking about strangers to Israel, aliens, foreigners. Why are foreigners especially associated with adulteresses? I asked myself that question. I don't really know the answer. I suggest that perhaps it could be that the ordinary Jewish woman would not think of adultery, the laws being so strict against it. I have read somewhere that adultery was never practiced by Jewish women. I find that hard to believe, but in that strict society, that very well could be. But when you get people, foreigners coming in who are not bound by that law, they might be more prone to committing adultery. And Solomon finishes up verse 10 by telling his sons that if you go into the adulteress, your hard-earned goods will go to the house of an alien. Again, assuming the alien is the adulteress, John Gill says that hard-earned wealth is spent in maintaining whores, bawds, and bastards. Well, maintaining the whore and maintaining the bastards, maintaining the adulteress. A whore's not quite the same thing as an adulteress. But the point is generally when the baby is conceived, the father feels a duty to take care of that baby. I remember the story of the legendary late senator in South Carolina, Strom Thurmond, whose name was like Bear Bryant in Alabama. If you didn't believe in him, you were an atheist. It turns out that after he died, he had fathered an illegitimate black baby right after World War II. That woman had grown up in another state, I think it was California, another state from South Carolina, and she was an old woman in her 60s or so when Strom Thurmond died, and it turned out he had been paying support to that woman all her life for 60-something years, and he kept it secret from the state of South Carolina until he died. Now, that illegitimate lady had nothing but respect for Strom Thurmond. In fact, she became a political conservative, just like Thurmond was. But that night of fun that Strom Thurmond had cost him a lot of money. We go now to Proverbs 5, 11 through 23, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon continues, "And you groan at your final end." He's still talking to his sons who have gone into an adulteress, hypothetically. "You groan at your final end when your flesh and your body are consumed, and you say, 'How I have hated instruction, and my heart spurned reproof. I have not listened to the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to my instructors. I was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation.' Drink water from your own cistern." We now move from the quotation of the sons who are bemoaning the fact that they have gone into adulteresses, hypothetically, of course. We're now back to Solomon's words in verse 15. "Drink water from your own cistern." He's talking to his sons. "Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. His own iniquities will capture the wicked." That, of course, is not referring to God. It's talking about the wicked's own iniquities will capture the wicked. "And he, the wicked one, will be held with the cords of his sin. He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he will go astray." In verse 11, Solomon says, sons, you're going to groan at your final end. Well, what is the end here? The end of the adultery or the final end of the son's life? It could be either one. When your flesh and your body are consumed, consumed by death or consumed by the STDs that you're going to get because you committed adultery. Could be both. You get your STD, your body gets eaten up with disease, and you die at the same time. Here's what Adam Clark says about this final end of the son who goes into an adulteress when his flesh and body is consumed. Quote, "In the line of my duty, I have been often called to attend the deathbed of such persons, where groans and shrieks were incessant through the ejaculating pains in their bones and flesh." In verse 12, Solomon puts some hypothetical words into his sons who have gone into an adulteress and who have been consumed in their flesh. Solomon says, "And you say, 'How I have hated instruction.'" So the son says, "Oh, I've hated instruction." Now remember, instruction can also be translated as reproof or discipline. "How I have hated instruction, and my heart spurned reproof." He didn't listen to his old man. Verse 13, "I have not listened to the voice of my teachers," the son continues, "nor inclined my ear to my instructors." I feel like as an ex-college professor, I should have known about this verse and put it up on the bulletin board. Listen to me. Don't wait till the night before the exam to study for the exam. I must have given that advice 30 or 40 years, and not once did any student ever take me up on that. Verse 14, the hypothetical adulterating son says, "I was almost in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and the congregation." What does that mean? Well, probably it means that the adulterer was made a public example of. So private adultery has public consequences. In the assembly, people are going to say, "Ah, there's that person that was shacking up with that whore or with that other man's wife." It could mean, and I don't think it does, but it could mean that the son was in utter ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation when it was proclaimed to that assembly that adultery was to be illegal and not practiced. And so then he would be ashamed when he heard that. I don't think so. I think he was actually made a public example of by people in the assembly who look at him and say, look at this adulterer. I don't think it had anything to do with a public proclamation against adultery. Another option suggested by someone is that the son committing sexual sin while attending public meetings, his eyes as an adulterer were full of lust and adultery. In a public meeting such as the Sanhedrin, but what women would be there in the Sanhedrin for the man to lust after? Public worship in the temple, perhaps, where there would be women in the courtyard, and he would be in utter ruin. I don't think you are in utter ruin when you're lusting after a woman. And how do you lust after a woman back then in those times when she's dressed from her neck to her ankles in a loose-fitting robe? No, I don't think so. He was in utter ruin because everybody, in my humble opinion, was looking at him and saying, look at here, look at this adulterer. Now in verse 15, Solomon says to his sons have now finished speaking their hypothetical laments, and now Solomon has turned back to speaking straight to his sons. He says, drink water from your own cistern. Now a cistern, of course, is a round basin that catches rainwater for use in the house. This is an appropriate metaphor because each man had one private cistern. One cistern, just like a man should have one wife, and he had a private cistern, just like a man should have sex privately with his own wife and not publicly with adulteresses. Water from cisterns quench thirst. Lawful enjoyments of the marriage bed quench sexual thirst. So that's an easy metaphor. Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Fresh water, of course, talks about the sexual delights of one's own wife and not the nasty, foul water from an adulteress. So we are at the beginning of water metaphors. In verse 15, we have a cistern, that's the wife, and we have fresh water from a well, that's the wife, mainly the sexual capacity of the wife, if I might put it that way. So those are easy metaphors. But now we get to verse 16, we have a little bit of an interpretation difficulty. Verse 16, Solomon continues, should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Well, first of all, in verse 16, we have a translation issue. There are two ways to translate that verse. One way favors what I call quote-unquote bad options. In other words, it's a bad thing to let your springs be dispersed abroad. It's a bad thing for streams of water to be in the streets. One translation favors that. Another translation favors what I call a good option for this verse 16. In other words, it's a good thing that your springs are dispersed abroad. It will be a good thing for streams of water in the streets. So let's look at the two possible translations. Here is the set of translations that favor the bad options. It's a bad thing for your springs to be dispersed. Proverbs 5:16 in the NASB, that's what I just read from. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? A rhetorical question requiring a no answer. It's a bad thing for your springs to be dispersed abroad. The American Standard Version. Should thy springs be dispersed abroad, and streams of water in the streets? No. It's a bad thing to let your springs be dispersed abroad. Here's the Bible in basic English. Let not your springs be flowing in the streets, or your streams of water in the open places. States it very clearly. Don't let it happen. That's a bad thing. God's Word translation. Why should water flow out of your spring? Why should your streams flow into the streets? Rhetorical question requiring a no answer. There isn't any reason why your water should flow into the streets. Here's the Holman Christian Study Bible. Should your springs flow in the streets, streams of water in the public squares? Rhetorical question demanding a no answer. No, it's a bad thing that your springs flow in the streets. The NIV says, should your springs overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares? Again, a rhetorical question requiring no for an answer. No, it's a bad thing for your springs to overflow in the streets. But now there are some translations that say that it's a good thing for your springs to be dispersed abroad. For example, the Darby translation says, thy fountain shall be poured forth as water brooks in the broad ways. In other words, it's a good thing, or at least it sounds like it's a good thing. Here's the KJV. Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the streets. Let it be. Let your fountains go. It's a good thing. Here's the Young's Literal Translation. Let thy fountains be scattered abroad in broad places, rivulets of water. A good thing. So, now we need to look at exactly what is Solomon talking about. Again, it depends on how you translate the verse. So let's assume that the verse is translated in a bad way, quote-unquote bad way, that it's a bad thing for streams to be dispersed into the streets. What are those streams? Well, the first option, the option that I actually prefer, is that it's referring to bastards produced by the man and the adulteress. Should your bastard sons and daughters be dispersed abroad? Should your bastard children be water in the streets? I think that fits pretty good. Here's another possible option if the translation is translated in favor of a bad option. Streams would be a metaphor for the man's drive and motivation and strength. So it would read this way. Should your sexual energy and your sexual drive and your motivations be dispersed abroad? Should your sexual energy be like water that's dispersed in the streets? That's not a bad option. Some people say it's a literal meaning, the man's sperm. Should your sperm be dispersed abroad? Should your streams of sperm be cast out into the streets? Ooh, that's getting a little explicit. Here's another option, assuming the verse is translated in such a way that it makes it sound like it's a bad thing for the streams to end up in the street. The man's wife herself turns to adultery. She becomes vindictive because of the husband's behavior. Her husband went into an adulterer, so the wife is ticked off at him. So it would read like this. Should your wife be dispersed abroad? Should your wife be a stream of water in the streets? I don't think that's a correct option. It's an unlikely motive that this would happen in that culture. Would a woman who's been shamed by her husband commit adultery go out and bring more shame on herself by committing more adultery? I don't think so. So if we interpret this verse or translate this verse as being a bad thing for the streams of water to be dispersed in the streets, it could either be bastard children or it could be sperm, which leads to bastard children. The ideas are closely related. Well, let's look at some options in case the translation is like the KJV. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. Let thy fountains be scattered abroad. Two options here. Gill and Clark mentioned these. Solomon would be telling his children, his sons, let your lawful offspring produced by your wife be dispersed abroad. In other words, have children and disperse them abroad. Don't go into an adulteress and create bastard children. Let your children be sent out into the streets so that they can grow up and be married in other families, at which time there will be blessings to the public. That's option number one, one of my good options. Here's option number two from a faculty member at Gordon College, I think it was, not Gordon Conwell, but Gordon College, a scholar named Chisholm, Robert B. Chisholm, Jr. He says that the streams of water that are to be dispersed in the streets refers to the ability of the wife to sexually satisfy. In other words, son, Solomon says, your wife has the ability to satisfy you sexually as a running fountain does, not just as a passive cistern, but even as a running fountain. But she is reserved for you privately. Chisholm says this metaphor of the springs in the streets and the streams of water in the streets is, quote, to emphasize the wife's capacity to satisfy. Solomon pictures these springs and streams of water flowing through the streets and public squares. Well, that doesn't seem right to me because this is a public thing. Is the son to say, look at my wife. She's really putting out for me. Whoa, boy, she's hot. I'm going to tell everybody in the public. I somehow doubt that. Chisholm is saying that the wife has the ability to satisfy as a running fountain as opposed to a passive cistern. So in verse 16, he's saying, let your springs be like that fresh water from the well that was mentioned at the end of verse 15, which of course refers to the wife. So according to Chisholm, verse 15 and verse 16 are flowing in the same direction. Solomon tells his sons to drink water from his own cistern, his wife, placid water, still water, and also fresh water from the well. That's still water, but it's still water from the wife, sexual desire, sexual satisfaction from the wife. And then in verse 16, streams of water in the streets, still the same idea. It's flowing water, springs of water. I don't think so, and most of the translations don't think so either. as I pointed out to you, most of them say, no, it's a bad thing for your springs to be dispersed abroad. So I'm sorry, Dr. Chisholm, we're going to have to disagree with you on that. We move now to verse 18. Solomon continues talking to his sons, and he says, let your fountain be blessed. Now, that's the third body of water. We've gone from cistern to well to fountain. And to make it simple, I just say that all these bodies of clear, clean, pure, fresh water are referring to the wife. Matthew Henry agrees, and Robert Chisholm, as a matter of fact, says that the image of the fountain transforms the image of the wife from a passive receptacle, that would be the cistern, to an active source of abundant satisfaction, that would be the fountain, and by then emphasizing that she is reserved for the son alone. By doing that, the father, Solomon, makes the son's wife look exceedingly desirable. All right, so if we take the fountain in verse 18 to be the wife, this keeps the three bodies of water consistent. The cistern, the well, and the fountain all refer to the wife. And also, the parallelism in verse 18 favors the interpretation that the fountain is the wife, because fountain is in parallel with the wife of your youth. Fountain at the first part of the verse, wife of your youth at the last part of the verse. Now, there are others who do not take that fountain to be the wife, as I just did. Some people say it's the man's sperm, the son's sperm. Let your sperm be blessed. Adam Clark, for example, takes it this way. He says, thy vein, and I'm not sure what he means by that, the vein which carries off streams from the fountain of animal life in order to disperse them abroad and through the streets. How delicate and correct is the allusion here? But anatomical allusions must not be pressed into detail in a commentary on Scripture. I just love that Victorian way of putting things. He's basically saying that it's sperm, for crying out loud, that's running through the streets. Thy vein, and I suspect vein means his tallywhacker, thy vein which carries off streams from the fountain of animal life, the tallywhacker which pumps out sperm in order to disperse abroad. I don't believe that that's what Solomon was talking about. Here's what Chisholm says about that. Some see the springs or the streams of water as symbolizing the young man's sexual potency, perhaps his semen, rather than the sexual satisfaction provided by his wife. According to this view, the son must reserve his sexual potency for his wife and not spread it throughout the community. Proponents of this view must translate verse 16 as a rhetorical question expecting a negative answer, what I call a quote-unquote translation for bad. I don't think it's sperm. It doesn't flow well from the previous metaphor of a cistern. We got cistern, well, and fountain. It's going so good, and all of a sudden you're talking about sperm. Cistern, well, and fountain referring to the wife, and now all of a sudden you're talking about the sperm of the husband. So in verse 18, let's go back to our verse. Let your fountain be blessed. How is your fountain of water be blessed? Well, you treat her nicely. You treat her kindly. You don't go into an adulterer. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. Verse 19, as a loving hind in a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Again, that tends to go with the idea of fountain. In verse 18, the preceding verse, your wife's sexual potency, let her breast satisfy you at all times. As a loving hind in a graceful doe, what's the point of that metaphor? And by the way, a hind is a doe, a loving doe, a graceful deer. A hind is a deer, actually, and a graceful doe is a female deer. John Gill says that deer are loving to their mates. So since your wife, son, is so loving to you and she's exhilarating you with her breast, maybe you better be nice to her. Maybe you should be chaste, pure, and fervently in love with your wife instead of chasing after one of these death-dealing adulteresses. In verse 20, Solomon continues talking to his sons, and he says, and why should you, my son, or to his son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? Exhilarated, of course, I think refers to sexual passion. Again, the adulteress is said to be a foreigner. I think it's because foreigners are more likely to be committing adultery, because Jewish women were sort of tied down by their law and culture. Why should you drink nasty water, son? Referring back to all of the clean sources of water, the cistern, the well, and the fountain that he's just mentioned. Don't do that. Verse 21, for the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, Solomon continues, and he watches all his paths. In other words, God's going to get you for that. To quote the words of a country song I heard years ago, God watches your path, and he's going to know when you go in to the adulteress. Verse 22, his, that means the sinner's, own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with the cords of his sin. You go in into an adulteress, and you're going to be wrapped tight, bound with ropes, and your sin will put you in bondage. And then in verse 23, you're going to actually die, because the wages of sin leads to death. Verse 23, he, the wicked man that goes into the adulteress, will die for lack of instruction. Instruction about don't go into an adulteress. And in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. So adultery is stated to be a great folly here. And it is. It's absolute stupidity. One commentator suggested that the man going into the adulteress, being held by the cords of his sin, is held by the cords of his sin all of his life because he can't get out until he dies. He's held by the cords, and then in verse 23, he will die. The idea is that the bondage and the cords of sin will last forever until he dies. Well, I think Solomon made his point, and I must say there is nothing wrong with scaring people about the wages of sin and how bad it is. I did it once when I put up a bunch of pictures of sexually transmitted diseases before about 100 Chinese students who wanted to see whether trial marriage was okay, and I let them gaze upon the warts covering people's faces and their genitals. I said, you want to do this? Go ahead. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. Ladies and gentlemen, with that final admonishment against adultery, we are now prepared to move to our next chapter, chapter 6 in Proverbs, which I will call Practical Warnings. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.